Hey, it's Diane. On my mind, what we learned from Trump's second impeachment and what comes next for those seeking accountability for the January 6th insurrection. This weekend, Donald Trump avoided conviction in the Senate, but he received more guilty votes from his own party than any other president in history. After the verdict, Mitch McConnell took to the floor and essentially called for a criminal investigation into the former president's actions. Meanwhile, Republican senators who voted to convict have faced censure by state party leaders, and Nancy Pelosi has called for a 9/11 style investigation. Ruth Marcus is deputy editorial page editor and columnist for The Washington Post. She joined me Tuesday morning to make sense of what happened and preview what's to come. Ruth Marcus, the Senate voted to acquit former President Trump last week, but new polls suggest he didn't fare as well in the court of public opinion. Talk about the importance of this trial.
Well, Diane, I know a lot of people, and I was not among them, but I took their concerns seriously. A lot of people worried that this trial was not a good idea for Democrats and for people who wanted to hold the president accountable in the court of public opinion, that it was going to be divisive, that it was going to interfere with President Biden's efforts and talk about unifying the country, that it would turn President Trump into a martyr figure somehow, and that it wasn't worth doing because the conclusion, his acquittal, because of the two-thirds requirement vote, was foreordained. I think that this trial really brought home to me the true horror, in a way, though I was watching it on television like all of us in real time on January 6th, brought home two things. As I was saying, the true horror of what occurred on January 6th, the scope of the violence, the fervor and scary rhetoric, and I'm not using strong enough words, of the insurrectionists, the real danger that I don't think we or they truly appreciated at the time, that members of Congress and the Vice President of the United States were in, as the Capitol was swarmed and overtaken, and of the ways in which the president, from before Election Day through the events of January 6th, not just the storming of the Capitol, but his reticence, to put it mildly, afterwards, the ways in which he lit this match, as Liz Cheney said. So I think having that on the record for people to see now, having that on the record for history to see in the future, making that case to the public, and making that case, frankly, to Republican senators who knew better than their vote. And seven of them had the courage to vote to convict the president. That was a bigger number, I think, than I had anticipated. I did not bargain for Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina. So I think that the whole ordeal of going through this trial, of reliving this event, was extremely important, even though the outcome was what we knew it was going to be all along.
Tell me what you made of Mitch McConnell's closing speech in light of the fact that it was he who had prevented the president from being impeached a second time while he was still in office.
Well, where to start with that? First of all, I think I'm going to start with the good parts of Mitch McConnell's speech, and I will get everybody out there, calm down. I'm going to get to the bad. Don't worry. The good part of Mitch McConnell's speech was that he called out President Trump's behavior for what it was. It was the but-for causation of the storming and desecration of the Senate chamber. It was a lie. He was the purveyor of the lie. If he hadn't laid the groundwork for and created the momentum for the insurrection, it would not have happened. It was appalling. And Mitch McConnell deserves some degree of credit for saying that. I will also give him some degree of credit, less, for saying that there is a legitimate contested constitutional question about the ability of the Senate, the constitutional ability of the Senate to have this trial. All of that said, it was awfully hard to take this after the fact condemnation. It was after the defendant had been acquitted, the juror gets up and says how horrible the defendant's behavior was, and yet justifies his acquittal. I think that it is important for the historical record. It is important as a benchmark, as Lindsey Graham was clearly unhappy in some of his comments on the news shows on Sunday with McConnell's remarks, because every Senate candidate in 2022 is going to ask whether he agrees with Mitch McConnell. I think that's going to be important going forward. The fact that it's sort of like the orphan who asks for mercy from the court on the grounds after he's killed his parents on the grounds of his being an orphan. Mitch McConnell may not have been the sole reason that the Senate trial couldn't go forward in time, as he claims, but he is one of the reasons. He was amplifying this in a piece in the Wall Street Journal where he said, well, the trial could not have concluded in time. This is a kind of very cramped vision of constitutional authority. And as I say, his constitutional protestations would be a little easier to take if he had all along been willing to call out Donald Trump. He has not been willing to call out Donald Trump, except for a few and quite muted examples, throughout the last 5 years.
It does seem as though Mitch McConnell, by saying that there is an appropriate place for the former president to be brought up on charges, puts the whole thing into the Department of Justice's lap, which certainly, I mean, it seems to me that with everything else on his plate, President Biden would rather not have to deal with.
Absolutely. And not only that, if Mitch McConnell feels as strongly as Mitch McConnell said, why is he not seeking a censure resolution in the Senate? Why is he not inquiring about the Senate's ability to use the 14th Amendment as a mechanism for having President Trump declared an insurrectionist and therefore ineligible to serve in a position of authority? To dump all of this on the Justice Department is just a dodge. And I think Senator McConnell knows that it's a dodge. And it's actually quite a dangerous dodge. The criminal law has standards, and I've been writing this throughout impeachment and in the impeachment trial, as the Trump defense was claiming that this was somehow some terrible desecration of his First Amendment rights and inconsistent with the standards that the Supreme Court has set out for criminalizing incitement. I think we should be very mindful of the high standards under the First Amendment for taking anybody's words, a president's words or somebody else's words, and turning them into a criminal offense. That is very dangerous, and the Supreme Court has correctly set out a very high bar for that in a case called Brandenburg versus Ohio. And so Mitch McConnell knows that it will be very, very difficult, if not impossible, for President Trump to be held criminally liable for his acts. It is a big hot potato that he is gleefully tossing into soon-to-be Attorney General Merrick Garland's lap. The criminal law is not the only way we express disapproval in this country. In fact, it's not a very good mechanism for holding people politically accountable for their acts. There are a lot of other better ways to do that. I fully believe, just to be clear, that there should be full criminal investigation of the insurrection, of President Trump's involvement in the insurrection, and of President Trump's other activities in and out of office. But I am very doubtful that he is going to end up being charged with a crime as a result of this.
So do you think that Nancy Pelosi's call for a full investigation of what happened on January 6th is simply going to be, forgive me, a waste of time?
No, 100% not. I think it is imperative, whether we find a political mechanism for punishing Trump or a criminal mechanism for punishing Trump, that we determine to the fullest extent possible what it was that happened. I would like to hear from Mark Meadows, the chief of staff. I would like to hear from the former defense secretary. I would like to hear from the Secret Service what information they were was being passed from Vice President Pence's Secret Service detail to the Secret Service headquarters and the Secret Service detail around President Trump. I would like to hear from all of the people who were in the Oval Office with the president that day or speaking to the president on the phone, imploring him to take steps to quell this violence, what it was that he was saying. We've heard these reports, news reports. They have not been convincingly disputed or disputed in any way that he was delighted with the insurrection. I would like to hear under oath from those who were with him. In fact, I would like to hear under oath from the president himself. And if he would like to contest this subpoena, that's fine. We have the space with a 9/11 type commission to engage in this sort of litigation. And he can, you know, claim a Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination if he wants. Let's go through this. I don't think it's a fanciful exercise at all. I think it's an imperative historical exercise.
I wonder what you thought if you saw Michael McConnell's column in the New York Times yesterday saying that the Democrats could have done better by broadening their case and not restricting it as they did to incitement, which is a legal term. And had it been a broader case that they put forward, they could have succeeded.
With whose votes? Whose votes were going to be changed by that? The Democrats have come in for a whole raft of criticism. They acted too quickly, but they didn't act quickly enough. They should have called witnesses, but if they had called witnesses, I would remind everybody who's listening that we are still, to this day, at the D.C. Circuit litigating whether in the first impeachment proceedings, Don McGahn could have been called as a witness. And I might not even be from those proceedings. It might be from a separate subpoena. It takes years to get through this. And if the incitement, and I think that some of the Democratic managers explain this on the Sunday shows, incitement is a legal term, but it encompasses more than just the precise legal analysis. It encompassed, in their understanding, and as they argued it, the president's dereliction of duty in the aftermath of the breaching of the Capitol. So it wasn't the mere words or form of the way the case was charged. It wasn't the absence of witnesses. It was the fact that minds were closed before they were sworn in to be quote unquote impartial jurors. And they were able to grasp at various life rafts, including the life raft of the constitutional argument.
Ruth, you've written that many Republican senators seem to be suffering from what you call Mar-a-Lago syndrome. Explain.
Well, your readers will be familiar with Stockholm syndrome, which is the tendency of captives and hostages and kidnapped victims to start to identify with their captors. I think this is Mar-a-Lago syndrome, as I describe it, is more insidious and less forgivable than that, because I don't think Republican senators and Republican House members, all but 10 of whom voted to acquit or not impeach the president, 10 House members, aren't identifying with Trump, really. They are simply cowed by Trump. They are cowed by Trump, even though he is out of office and ensconced in Mar-a-Lago, because they still fear him. They fear him because he's got a raft of, they're no longer his Twitter followers, but they are his faithful followers, 74 million Americans who voted for him, as was their right and legitimate choice. Millions and millions of Twitter followers who, I guess, he's back up on Parler, so they'll be able to follow him somewhere. He doesn't just have the mob that he can seek and clearly fully intends to sic on in Republican primary contests anyone who dared to oppose him in any way. He has the mob and he has the money, and he's going to use that money to help, to use a word of the day, incite that mob in a democratic way to end the careers of anybody who is opposed to him. And so Mar-a-Lago syndrome is not a, it's not crazy. It's an understandable fear, but it's still a lamentable fear.
Do you believe that had it been a secret ballot, there could have been a different outcome?
Would have been a different outcome. And the proof is in the Liz Cheney pudding. When there was a on-the-record vote about Marjorie Taylor Greene, the congresswoman from QAnon, and the question was whether to remove her from her House committees, Republican lawmakers who I think most of whom just recoil at the beliefs of Marjorie Taylor Greene and do not want to see more Marjorie Taylor Greens in their midst, wouldn't do it. But when there was a secret vote, as was permitted by the rules in the House Republican Conference, they voted not to strip Liz Cheney, who gave the strongest, most effective, most powerful statement condemning President Trump in advance of her vote to impeach him. They voted on her side because they knew they would not be held accountable by that man in Mar-a-Lago and his minions for their actions. But look at what's been going on in state Republican parties. It took a matter of hours for the North Carolina Republican Party to denounce Richard Burr. And Richard Burr, who voted, and God bless him, to convict the president, has the benefit, the freedom that comes from his announcement that he's going to be retiring. That wasn't even enough for some other lawmakers. I would point out others who are retiring, including Rob Portman from Ohio, did not even feel the freedom to vote. What I don't like to look into anybody's heart or anybody's motives, but he voted to acquit the president.
So we move on. Now, what about people like Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley? Are they going to face anything for fomenting what happened on January 6th?
No. No, I've been giving you very long answers, so that one's a short one. No. And I have to say, and this could inflame some people who are listening, I know there's this terrible, just incendiary photo of Josh Hawley, raising his fist in solidarity with the insurrectionists. But I am very reluctant to go down what I do think is a slippery slope of holding senators, even senators I disagree with very strongly, like Hawley and Cruz, somehow ethically, within the standards of the Senate, responsible for their actions.
Why not?
Because I do think that we then get involved in a war of all against all. If I am arguing, look, I've written a column that said Josh Hawley, it started with the words, Josh Hawley knows better than to foment the baseless arguments that he made about the opening or contesting the Senate and House certification of the election results. He does know better, but it's within his senatorial role to sign the agreement to contest that. And it did have the effect, I think, of helping to inflame the mob. Certainly there wasn't going to be a contestation that they could have insisted go forward and that senators vote on if he hadn't done that. But once you go down that road and call that an ethical lapse that's worthy of censure or something, I just don't know where that one ends. And so I've thought a lot about this and I really struggled with it. And it's possible that I'm wrong, but I don't see it kind of the same way I was talking about not seeing the criminal law as the best venue for punishing Trump's conduct. I do see the Senate ethics process as a dangerous venue for punishing Hawley and Cruz's conduct.
More of my conversation with Ruth Marcus when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Ruth Marcus. She's deputy editorial page editor and columnist for The Washington Post. So what about the cases in Georgia and New York against Donald Trump? What impact might they have?
So the case in Georgia, and I've spent some time looking at the Georgia voter intimidation, vote tampering law. I think that is just very clear case of a phone call that we not only know of, but that we have heard from President Trump to the Secretary of State, the Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, that looks like an effort to have him intervene in and change voter results. There's other ones that have other phone calls to the lead investigator. Just a remarkable notion that the President of the United States would intervene with, call the Georgia Bureau of Investigation's lead investigator and ask the investigator to be a hero, he says, and if you just find these votes. We need to get through the ordinary operations of the criminal process, through interviews and grand jury subpoenas and grand jury testimony, information that is fully within the Georgia prosecutor's power and duty to get to determine whether there is a prosecutable, winnable case against President Trump. And I have no hesitations about cheering that investigation on and seeing where it leads. Similarly, the New York investigation, which is really quite sprawling, and I don't think we fully understand the contours of it, but President Trump is out of office. President Trump has tried for years to stonewall New York prosecutors from obtaining financial information, including his tax records. That stonewalling is about to lose its power. The wall is coming down, and they're going to get it. And similarly, there seems to be a very serious potential case against the president for all the various manifestations of fraud, mail fraud, wire fraud, insurance fraud, bank fraud, because he was manipulating, according to reports in the New York Times and elsewhere, he appears to have been manipulating the system and giving low information about the value of his assets to the IRS while he was giving inflated information about the value of his assets to his lenders and his insurers. So let's let that process proceed and see where it heads. It takes a long time to do these complicated financial cases, so people have to have some patience with that.
So going back to this notion of a Mar-a-Lago syndrome, E.J. Dionne wrote in his column on Monday in the Washington Post that the Senate vote should convince President Biden that compromise with Republicans is simply not possible. Would you concur with that?
Well, I think that maybe there was some evidence to support EJ's belief even without that vote or before that vote. I think that what I would say to EJ and would say here is that process matters. And so process doesn't mean being a chump, though. And here's what I mean by that. The president, President Biden, said importantly during the campaign and in his inaugural address and since that he wants to try his best to unify a very divided country, that he wants to try his best to work with Republicans, including Republicans in the House and Senate. And he has some practical reasons to want to be able to do that, the first and foremost of which is the filibuster. He needs, for most of what he wants to do, if not all of what he wants to do, 60 votes to move forward. And so he needs, as a practical matter, even if it weren't the sort of better way to proceed, it's the way he has to proceed, because right now, whether or not it's a good idea or a bad idea to get rid of the filibuster, there are not the votes in the Senate because of the views of Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema, Democrats who don't support getting rid of the filibuster, to be able to do that. So the process matters even without that, because, Paul, it matters with that and without that, which is to say he needs to go through a good faith effort, what looks like a good faith effort, which is enough time to figure out whether there is, he had these Senate Republicans, 10 of them, come in with a $600 billion offer. $600 billion is not enough. It did not include the right things. But you have to go through the conversation point enough to figure out whether there is a way to move forward. At the same time, I said you can't be a chump. And being a chump means, and President Biden knows this better than anybody, not repeating the errors of President Obama, who frittered away 6 weeks, maybe more than that, on fruitless negotiations with Chuck Grassley and Max Baucus, the former senator from Montana, to see if there was a bipartisan way forward on health care. There wasn't. Senator Grassley has admitted that there was no bipartisan thing that he was going to agree to. So they were simply getting played. So there's this constant tension in politics between trying to do the right thing and showing that you're trying to do the right thing, both to the country that wants unity and to Republican senators who you want to be able to work with in the future, to demonstrate that effort at bipartisanship without showing yourself to be a total chump. That's where we're right now, in that middle ground.
If you cannot move forward, is it imperative to get rid of the filibuster?
Couple things on the filibuster, which I could filibuster on, and I'll try not to. First of all, we've gotten rid, for better or worse, of the filibuster when it comes to executive branch nominations.
Right.
And when it comes to judicial nominations.
Right.
Now, we could go back to how that has happened, but I would point out with judicial nominations that had the filibuster not been done away with, we would not have Neil Gorsuch, we would not have Brett Kavanaugh, and we would not have Amy Coney Barrett sitting on the Supreme Court today. There would be judges, justices, who would be much more moderate than those three because they would need to have gotten 60 votes when the Democrats were in the minority in the Senate. There are ways around the filibuster. Your listeners have heard about reconciliation.
Yes.
So you can do things that affect the budget through reconciliation instructions. So that's another way around the filibuster. So the question is whether the remaining ways in which the filibuster prevents progress through the form of passing legislation is whether the filibuster is so big an impediment there that it needs to be gotten rid of. I have to say, I seriously worry about the implications of that, because what goes around comes around. You don't have to imagine. There's just a whole list of what I would think of as bad things, bad legislation that would have ensued had Mitch McConnell moved to get rid of the filibuster when senators were, when Republicans had the majority in the Senate and when Republicans had the presidency. So if you believe that Republicans aren't going to hold the presidency and the Senate again simultaneously, then as an instrumental matter of getting good things done, if you're a Democrat, you should support getting rid of the filibuster. If you think that the benefit of what Democrats could do while they have the presidency and the Senate majority, however slim, outweighs the harms that Republicans could do if they were able to work their will with majority vote, then you should support getting rid of the filibuster. I am really, really nervous about the consequences of doing that.
But, you know, here you have Senator Lindsey Graham say that the Trump movement is alive and well. And if you've got Mar-a-Lago syndrome working with that, it sounds to me as though it's going to be very difficult for Democrats to get what Joe Biden wants to get done.
Yes, it is. And it was difficult in the Obama administration. And President Obama came out at John Lewis's funeral to call for getting rid of the filibuster. But it was appropriate to do it at John Lewis's funeral because the filibuster has its roots, as your listeners know, in the ugliest parts of the civil rights movement. And so, as I say, I sort of come down, I have not come to a final resting place, as it were, on the filibuster. I am really nervous about the consequences of getting rid of it. But I am worried, as you correctly point out, Diane, about the consequences of living with it, because they are also very costly.
Are you also worried about further violence that could take place, whether it's at Trump's specific urging or simply part of those voters who believe and continue to believe that the election was stolen from Donald Trump?
I am worried, and I'm not worried about 74 million people rising up in a violent way. We have an election and people went out and did what they're supposed to do, which is to vote for the candidate of their choice. And so even though no power on earth could have moved me to vote for President Trump's reelection, I fully support people's democratic constitutional right to do that. I do think there is a very, very scary, small, in comparison to that 74 million, but scary subset of those Trump supporters who are inclined to violence and who throughout his presidency, he refused to criticize or condemn, except when he was absolutely pushed to it after Charlottesville. The Proud Boys were there on January 6th and Trump had told them to stand back and stand by. And so they did. And he has been deliberately and uncharacteristically quiet, partly by choice and partly by Twitter silencing since the inauguration and his impeachment. But I think we're going to hear, I know we're going to hear more from him in the future. And I think that it's been clear from the assessments of the intelligence community and the Department of Homeland Security that we have a serious potential threat in our country, more than potential, from domestic violence.
What do you think the prospects are for anti-Trump Republicans to create a third party?
We're not very well set up in this country, unlike parliamentary democracies, for a third party to emerge as a contestant to the existing Republican Party. I mean, parties do die over time, but we've had the two political parties now operating for quite some time. It's going to be very difficult for that third party to emerge as a third party. It is also difficult for the reasons that we talked about for a kind of vibrant anti-Trump wing of the Republican Party to emerge. I do think that this is a piece of what Senator McConnell was trying to achieve by laying down his case, belated case and after the fact case, against Donald Trump, that he was trying to put the party on a path to a 2022 victory, to attracting the donors who are appalled by Trump, to supporting what he needs to get a victory in 2022, and to attracting the kind of sane aspect of the Republican Party, because I don't think that this sort of boiled down core of extremists can be a successful political party. But, and so in a weird way, I wish Senator McConnell well in terms of trying to build back a better Republican Party, because two-party democracy is healthy. The current two-party democracy we have is decidedly unhealthy because one of our parties has been hijacked by the worst president we've ever had and the worst feelings that we have as a country.
Some people have said that Republicans' best hope for taking the Congress is to limit who can vote and how ballots can be cast. I was reading this morning about what's going on in Pennsylvania and attempting to somehow rearrange the authority of the courts so that they are the ones who have that power in their hands rather than the voters. I mean, Ruth, this is nuts.
This is the best argument for getting rid of the filibuster. You cannot have a democracy that's effective and functioning if the rigs are ruled so that the majority of voters are not able to assert their will at the ballot box. If you have gerrymandered congressional districts such that people's political strength is not reflected in the political outcome of who's elected. If you can't get nonpartisan redistricting commissions to fix that, if you allow gerrymandered Republican-dominated state legislatures to, and Republican secretaries of state to adopt rules that make it harder and harder and increasingly difficult, whether it's through mail-in balloting or through voter ID or through limiting early voting times and things like that, closing voting polling places, all the things that we saw in the last election as efforts and that we've seen in previous elections, if they are permitted to do their best to squelch the votes, the ability to cast votes of those who they think will not vote for them, that is not democracy. And so if I were going to get up, and I may someday get up and make a very strong argument that it's time to get rid of the filibuster, this would be Exhibit A for me.
Well, I will be watching your column, reading your column, and watching where you go with this. Thank you so much for being with me.
Diane, thank you so much. It's great to see you, even on Zoom. It's great to see you.
That was Ruth Marcus, deputy editorial page editor and columnist for The Washington Post. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Steve Lack. Thanks for listening, all. Stay well, stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.